4 years ago, as I'm sure you all know, the Supreme Court struck down Washington, D.C.'s handgun ban in the Heller decision. This was the first time in history that the court had found any law in violation of the Second Amendment. The vote was 5-4, broken down along familiar ideological lines. Apart from its significance for the politically contentious issue of gun control, Heller was an important test case for the interpretive theory of originalism. There were virtually no relevant Supreme Court precedents, and certainly none that could be considered dispositive. Heller was also a good test case for originalism because the Second Amendment poses some genuine puzzles. Its text, for example, uniquely combines an explanatory preface and a command. A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, what does the preamble's reference to the importance of a well-regulated militia have to do with the right of the people to keep and bear arms? One usually thinks of constitutional rights as obstacles to regulation, not spurs to regulation. And it's not immediately evident, at least the typical 21st century readers, how this right to arms could or would contribute to the establishment or preservation of a well-regulated militia. A different kind of puzzle arises from changes in the circumstances to which the constitutional provision must be applied. American society is dramatically different from the world in which the Second Amendment was adopted. The militia organizations extolled by the founding generation have withered away, and advances in the technology of weaponry have produced arms that are far more dangerous than those available in the founding era. Is it even possible, let alone prudent, to apply the Second Amendment's command to a modern society in which it could have radically different effects than would have been expected in 1791? Heller was a good test case for another reason. The opinion was assigned to the court's most outspoken exponent of originalist jurisprudence, Antonin Scalia. And Scalia made a powerful case for two important propositions. First, the right to keep and bear arms is an individual, private right, not a right of the states to organize militias. Second, the purpose of the right is to enable individuals to exercise their inherent right of self-defense, including the right to defend themselves against criminal violence. But that's not enough to resolve the initial textual puzzle about the relationship between the prefatory language and the operative clause. Given that the Second Amendment protects an individual right, what in the world could that right have to do with a well-regulated militia? Scalia tries to show a connection by claiming that the right to arms was a pre-existing right, and that the Second Amendment's preface merely tells us why that pre-existing right was codified without changing its substantive content. Now, there are two main problems with Scalia's analysis. First, he says that the constitutional text itself, which refers to the right to keep and bear arms, implies a reference to a pre-existing right, that definite article D. That's a linguistic fallacy. You could write a law saying that the right to free medical care at government expense shall not be infringed. That would not imply that the right already existed. Of course, there was a pre-existing right to arms, and the Second Amendment could be referring to that right. But then you would have to figure out the scope of the right. In practice, the pre-existing right was almost unlimited because there were almost no laws restricting the right in America at that time. That's clearly not what Scalia meant, because he later endorsed a great many restrictions that did not exist in 1791. Alternatively, you might try to figure out what kinds of restrictions would have been acceptable if legislatures had wanted to impose them. But there was almost no discussion of such questions in the founding period because there was no reason for anyone to have such discussions. Legislatures weren't interested in adopting restrictions. The second big problem with Scalia's effort to deal with the prefatory language involves his claim that it merely explains why the pre-existing right was codified. His explanation of the purpose of the codification simply makes no sense. Scalia asserts, and here I'm quoting, that the Second Amendment's prefatory clause announces the purpose for which the right was codified, colon, to prevent elimination of the militia. That assertion is false. The text of the Second Amendment refers to a well-regulated militia, not to the militia. These are not synonymous terms, and Scalia himself acknowledged as much when he distinguished between an organized and an unorganized militia. Building on his fallacious premise, Scalia claimed that the Constitution assumes that the militia is already in existence and that it means all able-bodied men. That's not exactly wrong, but it makes nonsense of Scalia's claim that the purpose of codifying the right to arms was to prevent the elimination of the militia. If the militia is the nation's able-bodied men, they would not be eliminated if they or anyone else were to be disarmed. Scalia's argument also carries the fallacious implication, unknown to him apparently, that Second Amendment rights are limited to able-bodied men, which they're not. Elderly and physically unfit men, as well as women, have always had the same Second Amendment rights that able-bodied men have had. The Bill of Rights includes three provisions protecting a right of the people, and none of them contains exceptions for women or other subsets of the citizenry. The most difficult textual question, which Scalia never even addressed, is how codifying the right to arms could have been expected to preserve, promote, or prevent the elimination of a well-regulated militia. I believe there's a perfectly good answer to that question, but no answer of any kind will be found in Scalia's opinion, and that's a very, very serious shortcoming in a judicial opinion that purports to rely as heavily as Scalia's does on textual analysis and originalist interpretive principles. Scalia's failure to identify any textual or historical evidence about the scope of the Second Amendment right had spectacular effects when he addressed the principal question at stake in the Heller case itself, namely whether the D.C. handgun ban was unconstitutional. The court concluded that it was unconstitutional, but the only reasons Scalia offered are that handguns are popular weapons for self-defense among Americans today, and that he thinks there are good reasons why they're popular. That is not an historical or originalist argument. If it's any kind of argument at all, it's probably a disguised and incomplete form of the quasi-legislative interest-balancing approach that Scalia disdainfully dismissed elsewhere in the opinion. It's very striking that Scalia abandoned any pretense of originalism when he addressed the question actually presented in the case. What's even more striking is that he also included a series of astounding and unnecessary comments endorsing various forms of gun control that were not at issue in the case. First, he said that nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on long-standing prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill. Now, I guess that sounds reasonable, at least at first, but how long-standing have these prohibitions been? Scalia either didn't know or he decided not to tell us. Apparently, however, the first general ban on the possession of firearms by felons was enacted in 1968. Long-standing? That was 177 years after the Second Amendment was ratified and less than a decade before the D.C. handgun ban was adopted. Aside from the absence of historical support involving the pre-existing right to arms, the conclusion is inconsistent with what Scalia himself called the core of the right, namely self-defense. On what understanding of that core right does it make any sense to leave American citizens defenseless in their own homes for the rest of their lives on the basis of nothing more than a nonviolent felony like tax evasion or insider trading? It would make more sense to say that these felons can be silenced for the rest of their lives. Regulatory crimes, after all, typically involve an abuse of speech, such as making false statements to the government or negotiating contracts that the government forbids. But they don't have anything to do at all with firearms or violence. Next, Scalia endorsed prohibitions on the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings. He provided no evidence that Americans were forbidden to carry firearms in schools and government buildings prior to 1791, nor did he explain what makes these places sensitive or how courts are supposed to go about determining the scope of this newly announced exception to the right to arms. Is a university campus more sensitive than a shopping mall across the street? Is a government-owned cabin in a national forest more sensitive than a privately-owned hotel on a public road? Did the whole city of New Orleans become a sensitive place after Hurricane Katrina, thus justifying the government in forcibly disarming law-abiding citizens whom the government was unable to protect from roving bands of criminals, which is exactly what the government did in New Orleans after the hurricane? We are never told what limits, if any, there are on the discretion of courts to decide that certain places are so sensitive that Americans may be disarmed when they go there. And we're certainly not given any historical evidence to support such discretion. Scalia next endorses laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. Once again, he presented no historical evidence about the nature or even existence of pre-1791 commercial regulations, nor did he suggest any limit on the government's power to impose these conditions and qualifications on commercial transactions. For all we're told here, Congress could place a prohibitively high tax on the sale of firearms or create burdensome regulatory obstacles that would make it impractical for a commercial market to exist. If the court meant that it would approve only reasonable conditions and qualifications, it failed to say so, and it suggested no criteria based in history or anything else by which reasonable restrictions could be distinguished from unreasonable restrictions. The Heller Court also endorsed bans on the concealed carry of firearms. Once again, no evidence that such bans existed prior to 1791, no evidence that anybody thought they would be permissible. Instead, Scalia vaguely relied on 19th century state cases. None of the cases that he could have cited provides any evidence about the original meaning of the Second Amendment, and every one of them employed interpretive techniques that the Heller Court rejected. What's more, the two state cases that Scalia did cite relied on the proposition that only assassins have a reason to hide their weapons, whereas honest men carry their guns out in the open. Now, that may have been true in Georgia in 1846 and Louisiana in 1850, but it may not have been true throughout the Americas when the Bill of Rights was adopted, and it is certainly not true today. Finally, the Heller Court announced that the Second Amendment protects only those weapons typically possessed by law-abiding citizens for lawful purposes. Scalia indicated that short-barreled shotguns and machine guns are not protected under this test. Where did it come from? Scalia invoked a 1939 precedent in support of this conclusion, but his interpretation of the case was completely wacky. He also invoked William Blackstone's reference to dangerous and unusual weapons, but Blackstone did not say that it was illegal to possess such weapons. He said only that it was illegal to carry them in public when doing so would terrify the good people of the land. In a narrow sense, the Constitution was vindicated in Heller because the court reached an easily defensible originalist result, but the court's reasoning is at critical points so defective and so transparently non-originalist in some respects that Heller should be seen as an embarrassment for every justice who joined the majority opinion. Immediately after Heller was announced, several Chicago residents filed a federal lawsuit claiming that a similar handgun ban in that city violated the 14th Amendment. The plaintiffs relied on both the Privileges or Immunities Clause and the Due Process Clause, claiming that one or the other, or both, rendered the Second Amendment applicable to state and local governments. That became the McDonald case, which the Supreme Court decided 2 years ago. As I'm sure you know, the court held that the Second Amendment applies to state and local regulations in the same way that it applies to the federal government. Once again, the vote was 5-4. So here's where the law now stands. It is unconstitutional for any level of government to ban the possession of handguns in the home for self-defense. What's most interesting about the McDonald decision involves a disagreement within the 5-member conservative majority. Before I get to that, though, I'm going to give a little background in case there are any first years here who haven't learned this already. The Bill of Rights originally applied only to the federal government. With the adoption of the 14th Amendment in 1868, the Constitution put new restrictions on the states, including the two limitations at issue in McDonald. I'll just read what the Constitution says. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. In 1873, the Supreme Court read the Privileges or Immunities Clause very narrowly, holding that it protects only those rights that owe their existence to the federal government, its national character, its constitution, or its laws. Three subsequent cases during the 19th century applied this holding to the Second Amendment. In all three cases, the court found that the right to keep and bear arms, and other elements of the Bill of Rights as well, pre-existed the federal constitution. Under the 1873 interpretation of the Privileges or Immunities Clause, such pre-existing rights are not protected against state action. Shortly after the last of these three decisions, at the very end of the 19th century, the Supreme Court started taking a new approach. Rather than reconsider its precedents, however, the court started making some of the rights listed in the Bill of Rights, but not others, applicable to the states under the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. The theory underlying this process of selective incorporation is that the Due Process Clause imposes substantive limits on the government's discretion to interfere with so-called fundamental rights. The court has never even tried to derive this doctrine from the text or history of the Constitution. It's just something they made up. Most of the individual rights in the Bill of Rights have by now been incorporated through substantive due process, and a very few have been held to be insufficiently fundamental. In McDonald, a four-justice plurality reviewed the court's selective incorporation cases and distilled a test of fundamental rights. The test is whether the right is deeply rooted in this nation's history and tradition. Applying that test to the Second Amendment was quite straightforward. As Justice Alito's plurality opinion observes, the evidence to support incorporation under this test had already been presented in Heller, and Alito provides a short summary. The opinion could have stopped right there. Unfortunately, Alito went on to make an originalist argument as well, and that argument is a total flop. Alito repeatedly misinterprets what was said and done in the 39th Congress. There are several examples, but the most important involve two statutes that unambiguously provided for black citizens to have the same rights as white citizens. Alito argues in a completely unconvincing fashion that these statutes were meant to give everybody a substantive right to arms. A second and more practically important shortcoming in the Alito opinion is an express reaffirmation of the irresponsible dicta in Heller, and I'll return briefly to that at the end. As I mentioned, the heart of Alito's plurality opinion is a perfectly straightforward application of the court's substantive due process precedents. Justice Thomas concurred in the judgment, but he completely rejected the use of these precedents. He calls them a legal fiction that does not even have a guiding principle to distinguish between rights it protects and those that it does not protect. Thomas then undertakes his own extended inquiry into the original meaning of the Privileges or Immunities Clause, and he concludes that the evidence overwhelmingly demonstrates that the privileges and immunities of United States citizens included individual rights enumerated in the Constitution, including the right to keep and bear arms. On its face, and taken as a whole, Thomas's very detailed exposition is at least plausible, and none of the other opinions in McDonald makes the slightest effort to refute his findings. That said, there are some obvious weak links even on the face of Thomas's analysis. He repeatedly invokes evidence that does not support his case, and he even relies on some evidence that affirmatively undermines his case. More important, perhaps, there's a lot of evidence that he does not consider. It's probably too soon to say whether dispassionate students of the entire historical record will necessarily agree with Thomas's conclusions. Of course, a judge can't wait for historians to come to a consensus before deciding the case before him. And that leads me to what is perhaps the most interesting feature of Thomas's opinion. This may come as a shock after Heller, but he insists that the court should only decide the case that was presented to the court. As he points out, holding that the right to arms is protected by the Privileges or Immunities Clause would create no direct conflict with any of the court's substantive due process precedents. Thomas expresses no view about the approach he would take if there were such a conflict, nor does he express a view on other hypothetical questions where some conflict might arise between his approach and the approach taken by the plurality. Perhaps most important, he does not reaffirm or endorse the Heller dicta, as Alito's opinion does. For all his seeming radicalism, I think Thomas's opinion may offer a better model of judicial restraint than Alito's much more conventional plurality opinion. I'd like to close by raising a question that none of the McDonald justices raised. What is the legal status of the opinions in Heller and McDonald? We can be pretty sure how the lower federal courts will regard those opinions. The dicta will be treated as though they're the law. And when issues arise that are not covered, either by the holdings or the dicta in these two cases, federal courts will try to use language in Scalia's Heller opinion to predict how the Supreme Court would want those issues to be resolved. Some federal judges will behave conscientiously and intelligently. Judge Diane Sykes in the Seventh Circuit has been doing an especially good job. Some other judges have not been doing so well. One case, though, is especially interesting. In a recent decision from the D.C. Circuit, two respected judges, Ginsburg and Kavanaugh, took dramatically different approaches. Both Ginsburg and Kavanaugh claim to be interpreting Heller, but both of them easily show that there are serious problems with the other judge's interpretation. The real problem is that Heller is just incoherent in some important ways. The lower federal courts are stuck with that incoherence because they think it's their obligation to treat Supreme Court opinions as a kind of gospel or holy writ. Now, that may be appropriate in a hierarchical judicial system. The question I'd like to leave you with is whether state courts have the same obligation. It's generally accepted that state courts are bound by the holdings in both cases, and I wouldn't challenge that principle. But what about the dicta? And what about the analytical approach or the spirit of the Supreme Court's opinion? I don't think it's at all obvious that state courts should feel bound by that. Perhaps they could do the nation a service by writing opinions in Second Amendment cases that are better than what the Supreme Court has given us. I don't think that should be too hard. Thank you very much.
So thank you for that, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me. The society has a admirable record of trying to present a range of views on a number of important issues, and the I appreciate that. I'm not sure why I've been asked to speak here. To the best of my knowledge, I have never written or uttered a syllable about the Second Amendment. Probably it's because, as a former gunner on a 155-millimeter howitzer, I have fired a larger weapon than anyone else in the room may have fired. But what I'd like to do is talk about four isms. So Professor Lund very usefully situated the Second Amendment issue and situated Heller and McDonald within larger and crucially important issues of constitutional interpretive methodology. I want to do somewhat the same thing. As I said, it may be useful to think about this in terms of four isms. So let's start with the first ism, textualism. So one way to start by talking about textualism is possibly to start with a diagram, but I'm not going to waste time putting a diagram on the board. I'm going to rely on your imagination. So imagine that you are on the beach, a bunch of shells or rocks wash up on the beach, and they appear to spell out C-A-T. I think most of us would imagine that they spelled out the word cat. Most of us, in response to that or in reaction to that, would start thinking about cats. And the reason we would do that is because we exist in a world in which there are certain linguistic conventions. The rules of language are conventional. We are able to speak to each other. We are able to communicate with each other by virtue of shared conventions of language. They could be different. They might well be different. They could become different. They've been different in the past. But our ability to communicate is a function of our understanding of shared conventions of language. The reason I mention this is to point out that it would at least be possible, as the cat example demonstrates, to interpret language without reference to the meaning that the language had at the time it was first used. It would be possible to interpret language without regard to the actual intentions of the people who used it. This is not yet to say that that would be a good idea. It is to suggest only that, let us call it textualism, non-historical textualism, non-original textualism, is a linguistic possibility. Indeed, there is a view of constitutional interpretation, not very fashionable at the moment, which says nothing about whether it's right or wrong, that might be understood as current meaning textualism. Interpret the law, interpret any law, including but not limited to the Constitution, according to the current conventions of language. Stick to the text, stick closely to the text, but stick closely to the text as we now understand it. That might be a bad idea for a number of reasons. It might be a good idea for a number of reasons. But I at least mention this as a possibility, especially in light of many of the current debates and many of the current understandings, in order to emphasize the fact that originalism or original meaning or original intent, they're different. I'll get to that in a moment. As a theory of textualism, is a constitutional theory and not a theory of language. So at least it would be possible to look at the words of the Second Amendment. And indeed, a fair amount of Professor Lund's talk is entirely consistent with this, and some of Heller might be consistent with this. It would be possible to look at the words of the Second Amendment, try to figure out what they mean as words, as language, as the ordinary, intelligent 2012 reader of language would understand them, without making reference to history. If we choose not to do so, we choose not to do so because we have adopted a constitutional theory, or a political theory, or a moral theory, but nothing about the nature of language requires that we understand language in historical or original terms. So as we think about the possibility of interpreting the Second Amendment, at least think about the possibility that it could be understood or massaged or argued about or whatever we want to do with it in terms of the words that are written down. Again, if we choose not to do so, it's for reasons of constitutional theory, moral theory, political theory, not a matter of theory of language. Indeed, one of the interesting things about the preface or the preamble, very important in these debates, as Professor Lund talked about, is the way that it intersects with a number of important strands in legal theory in general and American legal theory in particular. Carl Llewellyn, among the most prominent of the 20th century thinkers about the nature of legal thought and legal reasoning, made reference to something he called a singing reason. A singing reason for Llewellyn was the purpose or reason behind the statute that was announced, it sang, in the statute itself, just like the Second Amendment. It is rare to have statutes written in that way. Llewellyn thought it was fabulous. Llewellyn thought there ought to be a lot more of it. And indeed, Llewellyn's view that there ought to be more singing reasons is itself of a piece with a large strand of American legal theory. Lon Fuller is perhaps the most prominent exponent that says that language in statutes or constitutional provisions ought to be interpreted in light of the background purposes of those statutes or constitutional provisions. By contrast, those people who think of themselves as formalists, I consider myself one of them, despite the fact that formalism is an all-purpose term of jurisprudential abuse. Some of it nevertheless embrace the term. Formalism would suggest that language should be interpreted according to what the language means, independent of what the purpose behind the language might have been. So certainly from a formalist perspective, slighting the preface or preamble or prefatory language in the Second Amendment would be entirely consistent or entirely plausible. Now, that's a little bit about textualism. Now, much of discussion of textualism these days goes by the label of originalism, the second ism that I want to talk about. But there are two very different kinds of originalism. Back in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, the most fashionable kind of originalism is what we might call original intent originalism. Original intent originalism says that vague or ambiguous or otherwise indeterminate statutory or constitutional language should be interpreted according to the actual intentions, the mental states of the people who actually wrote the language. Justice Scalia, who has been quite prominent in scorning this for statutory interpretation, not surprisingly scorns it as well for constitutional interpretation. And original intent originalism has come into considerable disrepute over the last decade or two, partly because of Justice Scalia's insistent arguments against it, partly because of some important arguments in the 1970s and 1980s by, for example, Paul Bress, then dean of the Stanford Law School, about how original intent could be interpreted at numerous different levels of generality, and picking the level of generality caused the supposedly constraining idea of original intent to collapse. And finally, original intent originalism suffered from some disrepute by virtue of the embarrassing fact that understood as mental states of drafters, the original intent of the 14th Amendment was rather plainly to permit schools that would be segregated on the basis of race. Post-Brown, therefore, the embarrassment of original intent originalism has become made it somewhat less plausible. Alternatively, therefore, we have original meaning originalism, which would look, as Professor Lund did, at the kinds of practices that were in existence at the time, that would look at how words were understood at the time. So it turns out, for example, in Heller, Justice Scalia looks at dictionaries that were present at the time, looks at the way various terms, particularly bare arms or arms, were used at the time in order to understand what the words meant at the time they were used. What did keep and bear arms mean at the time? Now, I want to spend a minute or two on an argument that Justice Scalia thinks of or castigates as frivolous in Heller. The argument that Justice Scalia castigates as frivolous is the argument that keep and bear arms, or arms, should be understood in light of the kinds of arms that were in existence at the time. Without very much controversy, we can probably say that in 1791, people were not thinking actively of, for example, machine guns, other automatic weapons, bazookas, grenades, and various other sorts of modern weapons. Justice Scalia says to even raise this point is frivolous. But why is it frivolous? It's not so clear that it's frivolous. Philosophers commonly argue about the difference between sense and reference. They talk about the difference between connotation and denotation. And perhaps most importantly, a great deal of what we know about language acquisition from cognitive psychology emphasizes the way in which understanding the meaning of a term, acquiring the meaning of a term, is largely a function of having some number of exemplars of how that term is used, some number of actual instances. Once we understand that, we find that it's a somewhat different question. How people understood the word arms in 1791 might very well be, for them, an understanding that was based on their observation of and perception of muskets, various other forms of flintlock weapons, and so on. Now, at this point, Justice Scalia says it's frivolous to talk about this, and in an important way, he's right, and for reasons in part that relate to what Professor Lund was saying. What makes it frivolous is that in order to generalize about the meaning of the word arms, in order to say what the word arms means other than the particular arms that were in people's minds in 1791, we have to engage in a process of generalization. We could say that it means only the weapons that were in existence in 1791. But we could also say that it means something broader, something larger, things used for self-defense, things used to protect us against people, things that you pull a trigger on and an explosion causes a projectile to go somewhere else, and so on and so on and so on. Which of these we pick, once we understand the original exemplars, once again, is possibly not, or probably not, entirely a function of original meaning. In that sense, the argument is frivolous, as Justice Scalia says. But what may be frivolous is the claim that originalism, at least as deployed by Justice Scalia in Heller, what may be frivolous is the view that originalism can get us to the results that he wants. Indeed, once we try to generalize from the original examples, from the muskets, from the flintlocks, we are engaging in a process of analogical reasoning. So the question to ask, and maybe the question to ask about 1791, would be a question like the following. Is a fully automatic M16 more like a flintlock musket or more like a barrage from a 74-gun warship? Once we understand the question in those terms, it's clear that it would be very hard to imagine what people in 1791 how people in 1791 would have answered that question if they had absolutely no idea of what a semi-automatic weapon or fully automatic weapon was. Briefly, my third ism, constitutionalism. Let me point out a remarkable coincidence. Virtually everyone who favors gun control as a matter of policy thinks that the Second Amendment is no barrier to that policy. Conversely, virtually everyone who thinks that most forms of gun control are a bad idea as a matter of policy thinks that the Second Amendment bans those policies. Two positions are virtually absent in contemporary debate. Position number one, extensive gun control is bad policy but permissible under the Second Amendment. Position number two, extensive gun control is good policy but nevertheless impermissible under the Second Amendment. The absence of those two positions suggests disturbingly that the notion of a constitution as imposing second-order constraints on first-order policy preferences has almost completely disappeared. And for those of us who are interested in constitutions and constitutionalism, the remarkable coincidence between policy views and constitutional views should be some cause for concern. Finally, the term, the fourth ism, the Supreme Court. Supreme Court decisions have frequently been analyzed by political scientists. The view associated with many political scientists is attitudinalism. That is, that if you want to predict Supreme Court opinions, you should look at the underlying political, social, economic, ideological attitudes of justices rather than precedents or text. If we are going to ask about the future of the Second Amendment, the future of gun control, the attitudinalist perspective would suggest that what we really want to find out is how do the various justices feel about gun control as a matter of policy, and that would be the best predictor of what they are going to do about the Second Amendment. Professor Lund started with observing that Heller and McDonald divided along familiar ideological divisions. That's certainly true. Although one of the interesting things about many of the lower court opinions, including the one he mentioned at the very end, is that sometimes the normal front page of the newspaper ideological divisions do not serve that well. Judges Richard Posner and J. Harvey Wilkinson, among the most prominent, among the most prominent non-liberal federal court judges in the country, are prominent critics of Heller. And in a number of other ways, Heller and McDonald present complex issues that may make the normal ideological divisions a bit less helpful. I will stop at that and invite your questions, or invite you to invite their questions. Thank you very much.